Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It is Tuesday, June 2nd, 2026, and this is our Commodities and Energy Edition.
Today, we are examining the widening disconnect between stabilizing inflation and the persistent volatility of global interest rates. We are moving away from the era of predictable central bank easing and entering a period of structural, long-term cost uncertainty.
So the era of cheap capital might be officially behind us.
And that shift is fundamentally rewriting the math for global capital expenditure.
Let's dive straight into the heart of the matter, the great macro shift, specifically focusing on the interplay between interest rates and the persistence of global inflation. Brent crude is hovering near $110 a barrel, and U.S. Treasury yields are staring down the 5% mark. Welcome to the macro shift.
It is a high-stakes environment where the price of energy is directly rewriting the rules of central bank policy.
It feels less like a market cycle and more like a global tug-of-war where the rope is on fire.
That's not an exaggeration. We are seeing a fundamental divergence where massive capital demand for AI infrastructure is colliding with an energy-driven inflation spike. On Bloomberg Surveillance, Geeta Gopinath highlighted that this isn't just one driver but a triad. Rising inflation expectations, an increase in the neutral rate, the R-star from 0.5% to 1%, and persistent fiscal deficits.
So we have a triple threat approach to making borrowing expensive.
There's a signal here, the mechanism is a crowding out effect. Think of it as a bidding war for limited resources. A-linked companies are now responsible for 50% of investment-grade corporate bond issuance and nearly 40% of junk-rated debt this year. This massive demand for capital, combined with a need for massive energy and semiconductor inputs, is driving up nominal rates through pure competition for physical and financial resources.
Wait, so you're telling me the AI boom, which everyone promised would be this great deflationary productivity miracle, is actually the reason my mortgage and car loans are staying expensive?
In the initial phase, yes. The build-out of data centers and power grids requires an immediate massive surge in spending on energy, copper, and specialized components like printed circuit and semiconductors. While we might see long-term disinflationary gains from AI productivity, the current scarcity economy is fundamentally inflationary. We are seeing a shift from efficiency-based trade to national resource hoarding, where countries are duplicating entire industrial bases for defense and energy security. This duplication is inherently inefficient and inflationary.
It sounds like we're paying a premium for autonomy.
That's a great way to put it. And that premium is being funded by massive government spending. We are seeing a structural shift where the U.S. fiscal deficit is projected at nearly 7%. When you pair that much deficit spending with the one big bill of government industrial policy, you get a persistent upward pressure on the long end of the yield curve.
But isn't the U.S. corporate sector somewhat insulated from all this? I keep hearing that companies have already locked in their low rates.
There is some truth to that. Bloomberg Surveillance noted that the U.S. corporate sector has developed a structural immunity to rising rates because nearly two-thirds of S&P 500 debt doesn't expire until after 2030. They've effectively termed out their maturities, which prevents the kind of immediate multiple compression we saw in previous cycles.
So the big corporations are sitting in a climate-controlled room while everyone else is out in the heat.
Stepping back, the heat is hitting the low-margin, interest-rate-sensitive sectors. On the 500-year history of the dollar, Brendan Greeley's research suggests the higher-for-longer regime is a permanent structural burden for industries with thin margins. We are seeing this specifically in the restaurant and consumer retail sectors, where post-pandemic inflationary passlaries have hit a breaking point because consumers are finally pushing back.
And it's not just the consumer pushing back. It's the banks, too. I've heard the shadow banking sector is starting to look a bit unstable.
There's a real systemic risk there. We are seeing a migration of C&I lending away from regulated banks and into the shadow banking of private credit. The danger, as noted by Shindrov and Sis, is that credit disruptions in this unregulated space cannot be easily contained by central banks, potentially externalizing the cost of a market breakdown to the taxpayer.
So if the private credit market breaks, the Fed can't just print its way out of it?
They can certainly try, but the mechanics are getting much more complicated. The dollar's global dominance isn't just about U.S. military power, it's about the Fed's swap lines. As David Beckworth argued in Macro Musings, these lines act as a centralized filter for global liquidity, rewarding dependable central banks with access during crises. It's a form of financial diplomacy that reinforces the dollar's reach.
It's almost like the Fed is acting as the world's primary insurance provider, but the premiums are rising every day.
And the premiums are tied to energy. If geopolitical tensions in the Strait of Hormuz escalate and lead to oil prices hitting $160 a barrel within the next month, we could see a Wile E. Coyote effect. This is the idea that if energy costs sustain levels above $100, the psychological threshold for economic stability could suddenly and nonlinearly unravel.
Which would force the Fed's hand, regardless of what the president wants.
That is the billion-dollar question. There is significant concern, mentioned by Dudley, that political intervention regarding rate cuts could cause the Fed to lose control of the long end of the curve. If the Fed is pressured to keep rates low while inflation and fiscal deficits are climbing, they risk unanchoring long-term inflation expectations.
It's a precarious balancing act between managing the current inflation and preventing a total loss of credibility.
And we have to remember that the marginal buyer of sovereign debt is changing. We are moving away from stable foreign central banks toward much more volatile actors like hedge funds and non-bank financial institutions. This shift is significantly increasing global yield curve volatility.
So the floor is getting much more slippery.
Much more. The only thing currently acting as a stabilizer is the demographic shift. The massive influx of savings from aging populations provides the supply of capital needed to offset the rising global debt. Without that, the capital scarcity we are entering would be even more aggressive.
It feels like we are transitioning from an era of cheap everything to an era where every input, from labor to energy to capital, is a contested resource.
So here's the picture. We are moving from a global savings glut to a period of intense competition for capital and resources. The winners will be those who can navigate this higher cost, higher volatility landscape.
Investors in low-margin consumer sectors need to reevaluate their debt structures before the higher-for-longer reality erodes their remaining capital efficiency. Keep a close eye on the 2-year TIPS breakevens, because a significant move there will signal whether the market believes energy-driven inflation is a temporary spike or a permanent fixture. But as the energy market tightens, all eyes are turning toward the potential for a total blockade in the Middle East. On one side, you have the hope of a diplomatic breakthrough in the Middle East, and on the other, the reality of a massive physical bottleneck that seems to be strangling the global energy supply. Which side would you bet on today?
If you're betting on stability, you might be holding a losing hand. We are currently looking at the Strait of Hormuz bottleneck, and the structural reality is much grimmer than the headlines suggest.
You always go straight for the gloom, Alex. Can we at least start with the hope side? Is there a light at the end of the tunnel, or is the tunnel actually just a decommissioned oil tanker?
It's less of a tunnel and more of a logistical deadlock. While there is talk of a price negotiation regarding Iranian nuclear materials, as macro voices argued, the physical reality is that the strait has been effectively closed for nearly 100 days. This isn't just a minor delay. We are seeing a massive, unprecedented supply shock where roughly 1 billion barrels of oil have been removed from the market. That is 20% of global energy production simply gone.
1 billion barrels. That sounds like a number pulled from a movie script. How does that not immediately send oil prices into the stratosphere?
That is the great mystery of the current market. On Bloomberg Surveillance, Michael Wirth, the CEO of Chevron, noted that despite this massive removal of supply, prices remain lower than expected. The reason is a heavy dose of hopium. The market is betting that a resolution is imminent. Traders are essentially pricing in a miracle.
Hopium. So we're just collectively deciding to ignore the fact that the lights might go out because we believe a diplomat is about to perform a magic trick.
The pattern is clear. The physical impediments are massive. Macro voices argued that any rapid diplomatic resolution is nearly impossible because Iran's enriched nuclear material is buried under hundreds of feet of rock following the bombings in June 2025. You can't negotiate your way out of geology.
So the oil is stuck, the nuclear material is stuck, and the traders are just pretending.
It's more complex than that. The issue isn't just that we can't get oil out of the Gulf, it's that we can't get new oil in. We're seeing a systemic failure of downstream logistics. Regional storage tanks are full, and because of the risk of vessel attacks, new ships are terrified to enter the strait. It's a self-reinforcing loop. Full tanks halt production, which prevents new ships from needing to enter, which keeps the risk profile high.
And I suppose the shipowners aren't exactly rushing into a minefield for the sake of the global economy.
Two things stand out. Bloomberg Surveillance noted that the speed of recovery is bottlenecked by the psychological risk assessment of private shipowners. They hold the ultimate decision-making power. Regardless of what official security assurances the US or UK might provide, if a captain decides the risk to crew and assets is too high, the strait stays closed.
The real choke point isn't just the strait itself, it's the fear in the captain's quarters.
It is.
And this is reshaping everything from jet fuel to base oils. For instance, in the jet fuel market, we are seeing a bifurcated pricing structure. Because 80% to 90% of Asian jet products are loaded in the Persian Gulf, the lack of access has sent Singapore cash premiums skyrocketing from $8 to a peak of $40 per barrel. Essentially, barrels inside the Gulf are heavily discounted because they are trapped, while cargoes loading elsewhere fetch massive premiums.
So Asia is starving for fuel and Europe is scavenging the leftovers.
Something to flag here, we're seeing U-turns in trade. Australia is now sourcing fuel from the US Gulf Coast to compensate for the Middle Eastern losses. However, it's not a clean swap. Argus Media reports a double whammy for Asian refiners. they are forced to shift from heavy sour crudes to U.S. light sweet crude, which creates massive operational inefficiencies and forces production cuts.
It sounds like a game of musical chairs, but every time the music stops, someone loses a refinery.
And the impact is even hitting the chemical side. In the base oil market, the closure is causing severe shortages of Group 3 grades. In the UAE, they are facing a structural demand-supply trap where they've exhausted their Group 1 and 2 stocks, but because they can't export finished lubricants, they are forced to implement widespread production cuts.
Okay, so if the strait is a death trap, is anyone actually building a way around it? Or are we just waiting for the inevitable?
The pivot toward bypassing maritime choke points is already happening through massive infrastructure investments. We are seeing a long-term shift toward projects like the UAE's pipeline to Fujairah and potential northbound pipelines from Iraq through Turkey. The goal is to decouple energy security from these specific maritime vulnerabilities.
I also heard a rumor that the closure might not be as total as it looks. Something about a shadow flow.
That's a fascinating piece of the puzzle. Acro Voices suggested that an unannounced side agreement between President Trump and Xi Jinping might be facilitating a shadow oil flow, evidenced by Chinese-flagged vessels moving oil through the strait even while other traffic is virtually non-existent.
So even in a global blockade, there's always a back door if you have the right friends.
It certainly seems that way. But until the logistics of the strait are resolved, not just through military clearance of mines, but through a complex, prioritized traffic management system, the global energy supply chain remains in a state of profound fragility.
Refiners in Asia need to accelerate their transition to U.S. light sweet crudes before the inventory gap becomes unmanageable.
Keep a close eye on the Singapore jet fuel premiums. Any sustained plateau at those $40 levels will signal that the hopium has officially run out.
But that level of disruption in shipping only tells half the story, because the real tension lies in how the money itself is moving through these broken routes. We all thought the biggest risk in global trade was just higher prices, but it turns out the real nightmare is just things not moving at all.
It's not just about the cost of the cargo, Maya, it's about the cost of the weight.
Right, because if a ship stops, the price of oil goes up, the shipping insurance becomes a mortgage payment, and suddenly my morning latte costs more because the cocoa bean is stuck in a geopolitical traffic jam.
That's exactly what we're seeing in the plumbing of commodity finance right now. We're looking at a massive disruption in the financing of motion. On Oddlots, Lewis of Brown Brothers Harriman described commodity finance not as speculation, but as the business of utilizing self-liquidating loans secured by physical inventory to help merchants manage supply chains. But when you hit a bottleneck like the Strait of Hormuz or the Red Sea reroutes, that motion stops.
And when the motion stops, the money gets stuck.
It's a velocity of turnover crisis. When vessels are forced to reroute around the Cape of Good Hope, you aren't just adding days to a voyage, you're freezing working capital. We've seen the cost of financing in a Framex vessel jump from roughly $45 million to over $70 million. As Oddlots noted, the primary risk of these prolonged maritime choke points isn't necessarily the loss of the cargo itself, but the trapped capital, tens of billions of dollars in liquidity simply immobilized in ships that can't move.
So you have billions of dollars just sitting in the middle of the ocean, accruing interest and doing nothing.
And that creates a lethal feedback loop. You might be on the right side of a trade, meaning you own the physical commodity and the price is rising. But if you can't move the goods, you hit what traders call the margin call trap. Rising prices force you to find immediate liquid capital to maintain your hedges. And if your capital is tied up in a stuck tanker, you can face insolvency even while your paper profits are skyrocketing.
It sounds like a very expensive way to go broke.
It is.
And the structural landscape is changing too. The traditional European banks that used to underwrite these massive flows are exiting the sector due to regulatory pressures and ESG mandates. This is leaving a vacuum being filled by specialized US banks and institutional investors looking for uncorrelated floating rate assets.
So the old guard is retreating and the new players are stepping into a minefield.
They are, but they're looking for edge in places the giants won't go. While firms like Citadel or Jane Street focus on high frequency execution, there is a massive opportunity in non-scalable niche markets. As some analysts have pointed out, you can find a quantitative edge in less liquid markets like oats or orange juice, where you can exploit structural risk premiums and delivery window economics that simply cannot support massive capital scales.
Speaking of things moving around the world, I'm seeing a lot of movement in the energy and fertilizer sectors that looks less like trade and more like musical chairs.
That's a fair way to put it. Look at the LPG market. Because of the war in Iran and the blockade in the Strait of Hormuz, butane prices in the Far East Index hit $1,200 per ton back in March. To compensate, the U.S. has become a critical alternative supplier for India and Southeast Asia. But there's a massive bottleneck in the U.S. infrastructure itself. According to Argus Media, while the U.S. leads in LPG exports, our terminals are way too optimized for propane. At Enterprise's Houston terminal, for example, the loading speed for butane is only about 45% of what it is for propane, 9,000 barrels per hour versus 17,000.
So we have the supply, but we can't actually get it onto the ships fast enough.
It's a mismatch of capacity. And we're seeing a similar phenomenon in fertilizers. The disruption in the Middle East has spiked the cost of essential feedstocks like sulfur and ammonia. New Orleans, we're seeing a strange trend where urea is being imported only to be immediately re-exported, about 4.
Wait, so we're paying to move it into the US just to ship it right back out?
It's pure arbitrage. Traders are prioritizing immediate global price premiums over domestic demand. They're using New Orleans as a pass-through hub because the international indexes are just too high to ignore, even if it means US farmers are left dealing with the supply squeeze. We're seeing a massive sustained supply shock in phosphates that is fundamentally reorienting how these goods flow.
It feels like the entire global supply chain is being rewired in real time, and not necessarily for the better.
It's a shift toward more permanent, longer, and more expensive routes. Whether it's isocyanate flows diverting from the Middle East toward Latin America, or the US butane market moving toward a structural oversupply as shale liquids expand, the era of efficient, cheap, and easy is being replaced by a landscape of fragmented, high-cost corridors.
Investors need to stop looking at the cargo and start looking at the speed of the ships.
If the cost of an Aframax charter stays north of $70 million for the next quarter, the trapped capital problem will move from a localized disruption to a systemic liquidity crisis.
But if we can't even keep the energy flowing, how are we supposed to power the massive new data centers required for the upcoming AI explosion? I don't know, Alex. I'm looking at these massive data center builds in Richmond, and I'm starting to think the AI revolution is really just a very expensive way to run out of copper and electricity.
It's more than just a shortage, Maya. We're seeing a fundamental shift where the primary bottleneck in the semiconductor sector is moving away from chip overcapacity and toward the physical infrastructure of the power grid, specifically the availability of transformers and energy resources.
We've gone from worrying about too many chips to not enough plugs.
On Bloomberg Surveillance, analysts noted that the real risk is now a bottleneck crisis involving the grid itself. This is driving a crowding out effect where massive capital demand for AI infrastructure raises real interest rates, while simultaneous inflationary pressure on energy, copper, and skilled labor raises nominal rates.
It sounds like a great way to ensure my grocery bill stays high while NVIDIA's engineers fight over the last available transformer.
It's a massive structural squeeze. Even the supply chains for the raw materials are hitting a wall. For instance, in Zambia, mineral production is being forced to scale back because localized electricity shortages are literally choking the mines.
So we are building these agentic AI systems that can think for themselves, but we can't even find enough juice to keep them awake.
That is the billion-dollar question. On Bloomberg Surveillance, the debate is whether the cost of token demand and usage can actually scale to provide a productivity return that justifies the massive energy expense relative to human labor.
I'm sure the shareholders are very optimistic about paying a 20% premium for electricity just to see a chatbot write a poem.
But if you look at the secondary layers, the opportunity is shifting. On Single Best Idea, Emily Rowland and Aaron McLaughlin suggested that investors should look for picks and shovels opportunities within the utilities and industrial sectors that support this demand. We are seeing the physical manifestation of this in projects like Google's Project Peanut.
It's a very expensive way to build a digital playground.
It's an industrial transformation. We are seeing growth driven by interest rate insensitive drivers like this AI infrastructure boom and massive government spending, which may sustain GDP even as housing and autos slow down.
Utility companies are rewriting their 5-year CapEx plans. We just need to see if the next quarterly transformer delivery schedule actually meets the projected data center load. But if we can't even power the silicon, how are we supposed to manage the economics of storing energy in molecules? So we're essentially building a massive global plumbing project where we turn gas into liquid, ship it across oceans, and then turn it back into gas, all while paying a premium for the privilege. Is this new energy frontier or just a very expensive way to move molecules around?
It's an optimization game now, Maya. We're seeing hydrogen pricing drop from $5 per kilo toward $3, but as S&P Global's Vipul Garg notes, that's not a magic trick. It's driven by aggressive reverse auctions and India's unnaughty scheme. The real issue for commodity traders is the structural cost premium for exports. To get Indian hydrogen to Europe, you have to convert it to ammonia for transport and then crack it back at ports like Rotterdam or Antwerp, which adds massive energy and carbon overhead.
Europe is building the expensive decracking machines, while India is just using the ammonia for fertilizer.
We can trace that further. There is a massive divergence in strategy. While Europe invests in cracking infrastructure, India is focusing on domestic green ammonia for agriculture. It creates this bifurcated pricing model where Indian domestic tenders can hit as low as ₹279 per kilo, while international offtake expectations stay anchored much higher, around $650 to $700 per ton.
It sounds like a logistical nightmare. And if we can't move the hydrogen, I suppose we're just banking on massive batteries to bridge the gap.
Batteries are the quick fix for immediate volatility, but they have a window of maybe 2 hours. Argus Media argues the real revenue stack for investors depends on accessing multiple markets, like the UK does, but we can't ignore long-duration needs. We need pumped hydro for that 40-hour discharge stability. Plus, unlike the battery supply chain, which faces a massive dependency on a single non-EU nation, the components for pumped hydro can be produced entirely within Europe.
Right, because the atoms are already there, we just need the gravity.
Worth noting, Macro Voices argued that the transition from molecules to atoms defines this era, moving from volatile fossil fuel commodities toward more stable, distributed technologies. The bottleneck isn't just production, it's the midstream infrastructure, like the specialized liquid hydrogen carriers currently being ordered in Japan.
European regulators need to decide if they're willing to subsidize that cracking complexity, or if they'll force a standard that recognizes India's grid as functionally equivalent. Watch the next round of ammonia terminal commissions in the Netherlands to see if the midstream capacity can actually keep pace with the production surge. As we wrap up this edition, the common thread connecting everything from the Strait of Hormuz to the silicon wafers in an AI data center is a fundamental pivot from a world of optimized flow to a world of fortified stockpiles. We are moving away from a period where we relied on the frictionless movement of molecules and capital into a reality where the sheer physical difficulty of moving atoms, whether that is Brent crude at $110 or hydrogen through a new infrastructure, is becoming the primary driver of global cost structures.
Exactly, Maya. The single most critical implication here isn't just the headline inflation, but the changing calculus for the heavy industrial players and sovereign treasuries. Specifically, as U.S. Treasury yields approach 5% and the fiscal deficit looms large, the cost of financing the massive physical buildout required for the AI revolution, the transformers, the grids, and the maritime fleets, is no longer a secondary concern. It is now a primary constraint on technological progress. For a decision maker at a firm like Chevron or a utility provider, the era of assuming cheap capital will bridge the gap between innovation and infrastructure is officially over. You can no longer rely on software speed to outrun hardware scarcity.
It's a landscape where the bottleneck is moving from the digital code to the physical loading terminal.
The implication runs deeper to see if this structural shift is hardening or if we are still in a period of transient volatility. Keep a close eye on the Singapore jet fuel premiums. If we see those regional spikes continue to decouple from broader market averages, it will confirm that we aren't just facing temporary supply disruptions, but a permanent high-cost baseline for the new energy economy.
Thanks for joining us for this weekly digest. We'll be back next Tuesday with more.